Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Nicholas of Cusa, as we pronounce him, out here in Australia. And this is podcast 8. And we've just read through and suddenly had a big surprise that his conclusion is that God is a mathematician and that we play at being God by doing maths. And it's pretty amazing. You can see there's sort of like a mind storm before he comes up with maths. And so it's just really interesting. We're up to part 3. So the last one was 2.3.3. This is big section 3. A Neoplatonism of His Own, capital H, His Own, referring to God. How does Nicholas' Neoplatonism aid in the thinking about God? One advantage is that Nicholas can take the basic asymmetry between paradigmic Platonic forms and the perceptual realm of particular things that are images of the forms and apply the asymmetry to the way the first principle, God, is related to all other created realities. In working out this relationship, Plato proposed that what results from individual forms is that all particulars participate in the relevant form, just as the way an image reflects and depends on its original. That is to say, the form does not require the particulars but is prior ontologically. The relation between form and particulars is not one of reciprocal dependence. Applied to the first ontological principle, or to the Christian God, the result is to let all multiple complex creatures participate in their ultimate source, while the divine creator remains simple, unparticipated, and unchanged. As Christian medieval thinkers, even Aristotelians agreed on this point, were accustomed to express this. Creatures depend on God, while God is not at all dependent on creatures. All the dependence is one way. And this is to do with the Trinity and all this type of stuff. If you look at various things, the Arian heresy, seems rather minus, but this is what the people are looking at, the Arian heresies. Arian heresy led to Islam. So the Arian heresy, this poor chap got punched in the face by Saint Nicholas. So Santa punched a heretic. It's well worth going back into reading some of this Christian history. And that dependence is interpreted in the Platonic and biblical terms as the dependence of creaturely image of the divine original. While the total reality of an image requires the influence of the original, there is nothing about the latter that is ontologically is needed of the image. I'll have to find out what that word means. I'm getting an idea now by its use. In Platonism, this effectively means there is separation of intelligible and perceptible realms in the fact that perceptible cannot exist without the very intelligible that abides unaffected in the realm of the multiplicity and change. While not themselves forms, perceptible things are not really separate from the intelligible forms on which they depend. Not less than the form is perceptible from the things in Platonism and Neoplatonism. In Christian Neoplatonism, creator and the creatures are bound together in a parallel asymmetry. So you have to understand Plato's idea of the forms. Just really mind-bending stuff that Aristotle sort of bypassed by actually just getting on with his pseudoscience. Or circular arguments. At least the form doesn't have a big circular argument at the centre of it, whereas Aristotle is a very long-winded circular argument. If you just wade through this page and say, oh, that is a circular argument. Let's go and continue reading. In this asymmetry, if this rate, asymmetry is rethought in terms of the presence required for the creatures to be all that they are by nature, it will turn out that God, or the One, in a non-Christian Neoplatonism, the greater the priority reality must always be there if creaturely reality is to be forthcoming and to continue. Now, creatures are created images can stand for manifestations and reflections of, and for Christian thinkers the likeness to, as well as the dependence of on God, for the divine presence penetrates and encompasses each and all the creatures without ever being limited or captured by any of them. While Plato's forms play a definitive role in the perceptual realm as responsible for the determinate characteristics of things, they count as a kind of presence of present absence. No less determinative is the ongoing presence of the Christian God, and that too thus becomes a kind of absence. How should we attempt to understand this? Well, you can. It's interesting, in the ancient world, one of the big questions was the chicken and the egg, which came first. Look, that is actually a really big question. And I believe Aristotle did research into embryology to try and figure that answer. And that's how he became famous. That's his shingle, where he actually earned big fame on that one. So you can see it's sort of like the Plato wondered if there was a God. Now they have the God answer. Now they're trying to meld the two together. Our conceptions of the absence or presence of one thing to another, taken originally from the and remained most at home in the realm of limited physical beings. Here, presence to or absence from another involves the same sort of mutuality and reciprocity that the same corporal realm of limited things must always manifest. If body A is represented... If body A is present to or absent from body B, B is present to or absent from A, and vice versa. In other sorts of important presence or absence, we are familiar with the presence in thought, in memory, and imagination, and affection, for instance, are metaphorical to some degree, and are extensions from and find their source in our experience of some prior physical presence, whether merely perceived and understood or hoped for or feared. So too, with the kinds of metaphorical absence we recognize when some present person, say, just not there. So too, with the kinds of metaphorical absence we recognize when present person is, as we say, just not there. So they're not thinking, I suppose, that's abstract. And absence, whether indifferent, bad or good, presupposes presence. Such metaphorical presence and absences of limited things to one another thus be understood as absent presences or present absences. There you go, that's pretty amazing. I've had so much fun reading these types of stuff. And so we are able to speculate about the case of a non-finite presence in absence by moving beyond the limits of the presence and absence we are familiar with in the realm of limited things. Now we turn to the presence of an unfamiliar infinite one, as is finally required, even if not obviously experienced, to keep creaturely imaged presence and real. In this case, we may think that the absence becomes what is metaphorical, and the presence of the first, capital, that's big first, that's him, that's Plato's God, first, is the truth. Truth ineluctably and literally necessary to explain the reality of anything and everything. But God's presence is hardly like that of one physical thing to another. Okay, so Plato said, look, if you go back, causality goes back, you could have the final cause, the great cause, good cause. It's pretty amazing that this has jumped, nearly 1,000 years of work, and this person is still muddling around with it. This means that the presence of God and God's identity with things is not to be thought as a kind of reciprocity, say that two created physical things that are present in one another, let alone similar or identical to each other. What is distinctive about Christian Neoplatonism is the ability to hold together dialectically in thought the insight it provides about this asymmetrical, non-reciprocal, ontological connection between God and creatures. God penetrates and surpasses or exceeds each thing God creates and encompasses. Creatures are thus themselves the real and limited sort of independence they manifest. Yet they are at once God and indeed one with God without being themselves divine. But what has this all to do with Nicholas of Cusa's having a Neoplatonism of his own? What is the characteristic of his thought? I want to propose is that the key passage. Key passages of major works he proposes this same kind of dialectical thinking to enable our grasping of a general relationship between God and creatures. So this we understand the limitation of our understanding. The thinking is supposed to reflect an ontological dialect, that is to say, a relationship that is real whether we acknowledge it or not. The dialectical relation between God and creatures is something towards which we mostly gesture in our efforts to do it justice in thoughts and speech. But this is not merely Proclus and Dionysus or Eugenia and Eckhart revisited in the 15th century. The answer is both yes and no. Oh my God. Oh, he's got a yes and a no paragraph. So here's a yes paragraph. Yes, the dialectical reality envisioned by Nicholas should be a little different than that pointed out by early Christian Neoplatonists. Neither Plato's forms nor the Christian God did or could change over the centuries, nor did the need of particulars and the creatures for their intelligible and divine originals. But also, no, for Cusa gives the dialectical relationship his own expression in a series of novel metaphors for the connection between God and creatures. Some of his original metaphors, such as the coincidence of opposites, enfolding and unfolding, God as the other, and the oppositeness of opposites, is controlled by and witness to the same asymmetrical relationship, yet led our speculative imagination in some new directions that would otherwise remain unexplored, i.e. he's looking at faulty metaphors and discussing them. It's pretty interesting. If only God can bespeak God's self in literal terms, then we humans are graced with metaphors. Okay, so that's all we can do is think of it metaphorically. With Nicholas de Cusa, what Nicholas de Cusa provides in his metaphorical forays is not simply imaginative originality, but a series of metaphors designed to remind us that there is no proportion between creatures and the Creator, that indeed there is an asymmetry between them. Moreover, our best ways of conceiving and asserting this necessary lack of reciprocal dependence should be built into the metaphors we choose. This is why one may not read the theory of metaphor to do justice to the Nicholas de Cusa's project of philosophical theology. Rather, the Cusanian project is Neoplatonic and is its own traditional strictures on any metaphors it chooses. The ontological determines the metaphors. The metaphors do not determine the ontology. I have to really understand that word. I don't understand it. What makes Nicholas' thoughts and Neoplatonism of his own is precisely the grasp the metaphors demonstrated of those ontological strictures, as well as the speculative imagination he evinces in the range of originality and variety of metaphors for what can be and cannot be understood about God's connection with creatures. Thank you. podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.